From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! In two classified cables to President Obama, the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, warns against sending in more troops to Afghanistan. Today, in a Democracy Now! Exclusive, we look at how the U.S. funds the Taliban. A new report in The Nation magazine reveals the U.S. government's funneling millions of dollars to finance the very same insurgent forces that U.S. soldiers are fighting. Then, is the EPA trying to silence criticism from within?
Cap and trade will not create confidence that clean energy will become profitable, and so it will not ignite the huge shift in investment needed to begin the clean energy revolution.
After two EPA attorneys speak out against cap and trade in an online video, the agency orders the two to remove or edit it or face disciplinary action. The two attorneys will join us from Berkeley. Then William Kunstler, disturbing the universe.
He fought for civil rights with Martin Luther King Jr. and represented activists protesting the Vietnam War. When the inmates took over Attica Prison, or Native Americans stood up to the federal government at Wounded Knee, they asked my father to be their lawyer.
A new documentary by the daughters of the famed lawyer, the late William Kunstler. They take an in-depth look at their father. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan's warning against sending more troops to fight in the Afghan war. In a last-minute dissent, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry sent two cables this week casting doubt on a troop escalation until the Afghan government addresses corruption and other internal problems. Eikenberry also criticized the lack of aid and development money allotted for Afghanistan. His request to increase non-military spending by 60% has gone unheeded so far. Eikenberry delivered the warning right before President Obama's war cabinet held a critical meeting Wednesday on proposals to send up to 40,000 additional troops. Eikenberry was appointed earlier this year after retiring from a military career that included commanding U.S. forces in Afghanistan in 2006 and 2007. Eikenberry's warning comes as a new poll shows a majority of Americans continue to oppose a troop escalation in Afghanistan. The CNN Opinion Research Corporation survey found 56% of respondents are against a new troop deployment. 58% say they're opposed to the war overall. As the administration discussed sending more troops to Afghanistan, President Obama visited Arlington National Cemetery to take part in a Veterans Day ceremony.
For the better part of a decade, they have endured tour after tour in distant and difficult places. They have protected us from danger, and they have given others the opportunity for a better life. So to all of them, to our veterans, to the fallen, and to their families, there's no tribute, no commemoration, no praise that can truly match the magnitude of your service and your sacrifice.
In Iraq, the Iraqi Interior Ministry says it's probing allegations the private military firm Blackwater authorized around $1 million to bribe Iraqi officials following the September 2007 killings of 17 Iraqi civilians in Baghdad. The New York Times revealed this week the payments were approved after the Iraqi government called for Blackwater's expulsion from Iraq, threatening the company's lucrative annual contract. It's unknown if any Iraqi officials ultimately accepted the payments. Meanwhile, former Blackwater vice president Kofor Black has denied an account from other former company executives that he confronted Blackwater founder Eric Prince about the bribes. In a statement, Black said he was, quote, unaware of any plot or guidance for Blackwater to bribe Iraqi officials. In other Iraq news, an influential American diplomat is facing growing scrutiny for standing to profit from oil interests in Iraq's northern Kurdish region. Peter Galbraith was a key advisor to the Iraqi Kurdish government during 2005 negotiations for a national constitution. Galbraith helped the Kurds win provisions assuring control over oil wealth free from the central government in Baghdad. But last month, a Norwegian newspaper revealed Galbraith stands to make over $100 million from interests in a Norwegian oil company and a stake in a potentially lucrative Kurdish oil field in northern Iraq. Galbraith worked for the oil company DNO at the same time as he took part in the talks on Iraq's constitution. He's been a leading advocate for decentralizing the Iraqi government and dividing the country along ethnic lines. Galbraith recently made headlines over his dismissal from the UN mission in Afghanistan after accusing his superiors of covering up electoral fraud. You can go to our interview with Peter Galbraith at democracynow.org. In Honduras, the Obama administration's facing growing criticism for the apparent collapse of an agreement to resolve the Honduran political crisis. The ousted president, Manuel Zelaya, says the U.S. has undermined its pledge to seek his return to office. Last week, Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Shannon said the U.S. would recognize upcoming elections even if Honduran lawmakers refuse to restore Zelaya. On Wednesday, top U.S. diplomat Craig Kelly left Honduras after failing to revive the unity agreement. Earlier, Kelly had said negotiations are still moving forward.
We are moving forward with the talks. We think it is very important for the dialogue to advance. We had a good meeting with President Zelaya and with Mr. Micheletti to encourage continuing talks. We think that the solution for the Honduran people is partly in the election, but we move forward with maximum international support, and that this be done through the Tegucigalpa-San Jose agreement. It's important the two sides continue talking, and we are here to support that process.
In Israel and the occupied territories, Palestinians mark the fifth anniversary of the death of former PLO and Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat Wednesday. Speaking in Ramallah, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said Israel's continued occupation of the West Bank and expansion of settlements there prevents any hope of a two-state solution.
We are demanding the vision of a two-state solution. They are disfiguring it. They are putting obstacles before it. They are trying to remove this concept from our route. What do they want?
Abbas recently announced he won't seek another term when Palestinians hold national elections early next year. A new study says unsafe abortions are putting an additional financial burden on struggling health systems in Africa and Latin America. The Guttmacher Institute says the treatment of complications from unsafe abortions results in up to $280 million in extra costs each year. Back in the United States, a new report says an overly strict enforcement of national anti-terrorism laws is leading to unwarranted denials or delays for thousands of applications for political asylum or residency. According to Human Rights First, more than 18,000 refugees and asylum seekers have been rejected or had their cases indefinitely delayed since 2001, despite no evidence of terrorist activity. Nearly half those cases remain unresolved. A top pharmaceutical market analysis firm is predicting the drug industry is set to reap a massive windfall from its secretive deal with the White House and Senate Democrats on health care reform. Earlier this year, the Obama administration agreed to oppose using government leverage to lower drug prices in return for drug industry pledges to reduce costs by up to $80 billion. A new study by drug industry trade group IMS Health predicts the deal will result in a sales increase of over $137 billion over the next 4 years. The IMS study predicts healthcare reform, quote, could lead to higher price branded products. Democratic Senator Chris Dodd has unveiled a proposal to consolidate bank regulators into a single oversight agency. Dodd's plan would eliminate the four separate bodies that oversee the nation's more than 8,000 banks and create a new consumer protection watchdog. Speaking in Washington, Senator Dodd said the measure would address the regulator gaps that led to the nation's financial collapse.
Our proposal will replace the myriad government agencies that failed, in my view, to rein in the risky schemes with a single, accountable federal banking regulator. We will end, for all time, I hope, too big to fail. Those words should only be used again in historical context. We cannot allow the collapse of a few firms to threaten the entire economy of our own nation and others around the globe, for that matter.
In health news, new figures show around 4,000 Americans have died from the swine flu since its outbreak in April. The Centers for Disease Control figure marks a significant jump from the previous estimate of around 1,200 swine flu-related deaths. And in media news, the CNN anchor Lou Dobbs has stepped down after nearly three decades. In a surprise announcement, Dobbs said Wednesday's edition of his program Lou Dobbs Tonight would be his last.
Over the past 6 months, it's become increasingly clear that strong winds of change have begun buffeting this country and affecting all of us. And some leaders in media, politics, and business have been urging me to go beyond the role here at CNN and to engage in constructive problem solving, as well as to contribute positively to a better understanding of the great issues of our day.
Lou Dobbs has been rumored for a new show at Fox News or even as a potential presidential candidate. A coalition of Latino groups recently led a campaign for his removal over his alleged anti-Latino bias in covering immigration reform. Last month, Roberto Lovato of the group BastaDobbs.com spoke at a rally outside CNN's New York offices.
What comes out of Lou Dobbs' mouth is hatred for Latinos and undocumented immigrants in the United States, is support for the extremists that are actually killing immigrants, like the Federation of Immigration Reform and the Minutemen, whose members in Arizona are responsible for the murder of 9-year-old Briseña Flores and her father. So Lou Dobbs is not telling his audience to go out and kill and hurt and attack immigrants, but he provides a platform for those that do.
In a statement, Lovato said, quote, "We're thrilled that Dobbs no longer has this legitimate platform from which to incite fear and hate." And you can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our full hour interview that Juan Gonzalez and I did a few months ago with Lou Dobbs. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. The U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan is warning against sending more troops to fight in the Afghan war. In a last-minute dissent, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry sent two cables this week casting doubt on a troop escalation until the Afghan government can address corruption and other internal problems. Well, today we turn to a new report that reveals how the U.S. government is financing the very same insurgent forces in Afghanistan that American and NATO soldiers are fighting. How the U.S. funds the Taliban is the cover story of the latest issue of The Nation magazine. Investigative journalist Aram Rostan traces how the Pentagon's civilian contractors in Afghanistan end up paying insurgent groups to protect American supply routes from attack. The practice of buying the Taliban's protection is not a secret. U.S. military officials in Kabul told Rostan that a minimum of 10% of the Pentagon's logistics contracts consist of payments to the Taliban.
That translates into millions of dollars being funneled to the Taliban this summer. Anticipating a surge of U.S. troops, the military expanded its trucking contracts in Afghanistan by 600% to a total of over $2 billion. Well, Aram Rostan joins us now here in our Firehouse studio, the author of the book, The Man Who Pushed America to War, The Life, Adventures, and Obsessions of Ahmed Chalabi. His latest piece, How the U.S. Funds the Taliban, was supported by the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. We welcome you to Democracy Now! When did you return from Afghanistan?
About 3 weeks ago.
So tell us what you found. How does the U.S. fund the Taliban?
Well, it's bizarre, but the U.S. has to maintain, obviously, all these bases, these forward operating bases and combat outposts throughout Afghanistan. They have to supply them. The way they supply them is trucking convoys, civilian trucking convoys. They call it host nation trucking. And what they mean is that Afghan-owned trucks and Afghan drivers drive everything. They drive all the supplies, the guns, the MRAPs, the ammunition. Just everything needs to get to these every part of Afghanistan. And they've issued these large contracts, but they don't protect the convoys. By definition, these convoys are driving through some very tough terrain controlled by warlords, by the Taliban, by insurgents. And what they've ended up doing, and this is apparently unanimous, with some small exceptions, the security companies reach arrangements with the local Taliban, the local warlords, and various insiders to pay them off for protection. It's very much like an extortion racket and very much like a protection racket. And it amounts to huge amounts of money. Some say 10%, some say far more than 10% of the convoys. Some say that most of the security budgets are going towards these payments to the Taliban and to the tribal leaders and the warlords. The fact is the U.S. often doesn't even know who they're paying off. These contractors don't necessarily know who they're paying off. They just know they're bad guys. So they've ended up with this bizarre situation, and there's nothing they can really do about it.
Well, your article goes into the shadowy, the network of companies and specifying several of the companies that are involved. And you point how many of them are headed by relatives of people who are high up in the Karzai government. Could you talk about, Watan Risk, is it, or what?
Yeah.
And NCL Holdings?
Yeah. That was the original story I was doing was this sort of web of nepotism and corruption and inside deals in security contracts and logistics contracts. And it expanded when people all started trying to tell me you should do this story as well. Watan Risk is an extraordinary company. It's run by two brothers, the Popel brothers. They're relatives of the president of the country. They're also convicted felons here in the United States for drug offenses. And one of them was an interpreter and basically a spokesman for the Taliban at the end of the Taliban regime in 2001. And yet here he is now. He and his brother run this very lucrative, very important, very big security company, Watan Risk Group. According to many people I spoke to, it runs this very important corridor. It controls it because it has a relationship with the key warlord and commander who controls that.
And that corridor is Highway 1, is it?
Highway 1, which runs through Kandahar, which leads you to the south, leads you to, in many cases, basically leads you to the war zone. This is where you need to go to get to the conflict, to the border and so forth.
Can you tell us where you start this article? You're mentioning these people like Ahmed Rateb Popal, but talking about what happened October 29, 2001, the news conference.
It's pretty bizarre, but in October 29, 2001, there's this news conference in Islamabad. If you remember, while the U.S. began its campaign against the Taliban, there was a Taliban ambassador in Pakistan who was talking as a representative. His main interpreter and representative was this English-speaking gentleman who looked very distinctive. He had an eye patch. He was missing an arm. He had this huge beard and this black turban. This is Ahmed Rateb Popal. He's now trimmed his beard. He looks different. He still has the eye patch, but he's now an international businessman rather than the interpreter for the Taliban. He's a relative of, like I say, of the president of Afghanistan. And it's one of these things where everybody seems to have to pay this company if they want security along this very important route. And they control convoy traffic heading through.
One of the other companies you mentioned is NCL Holdings, which is run by the son of the Minister of Defense, has a $380 million contract, but the Minister of Defense claims he knows nothing about the son's contract.
I believe him. It's a really interesting thing. In other words, he may be just the son. Everybody knows who he is, of course. Everybody knows his name is Hamid Wardak. His father's name is Rahim Wardak. Rahim Wardak was a Mujahideen leader during the fight against the Soviets. The U.S. worked with him. Case officers like Milt Bearden, a top CIA official at the time, and the station chief in Islamabad, he worked with him. The fellow shows up in the book Charlie Wilson's War, as does Milt Bearden, the CIA official. So somehow this general's son ends up starting this. He's an American Afghan. He starts this company called NCL, and last year, 2009, wins this contract that over the summer blossoms into a $360 million contract to transport American goods throughout the country. It's incredibly lucrative.
This is a guy who was raised and schooled in the United States, valedictorian at Georgetown, 1997, Rhodes Scholar, then interned at the think tank American Enterprise Institute.
Exactly. He's a very much an American, but very much an Afghan, and very much the son of the defense minister. The defense ministry is obviously key because that's where a lot of U.S. resources are going. We're supposed to be training up the Afghan army, which is overseen by the defense ministry, and the Afghan security forces controlled by the defense ministry. So that ministry is so important. But what's so interesting is I did, the only person on that case who would talk to me on the record was the father. And he himself seemed embarrassed when I met him about the whole situation. He just didn't know why his son had got the contract. He didn't even realize it was that big a contract. He realized his son's company
and
was doing...
And again, the contract was?
Was for logistics. It was called Host Nation
amount?
Trucking. It was a sixth of this $2.2 billion contract. It was $360 million. And even a relative of the president...
And your sense is that a portion of that goes to, obviously, to pay off the local warlords or Taliban when they're delivering stuff?
I have very good sources who told me that. They assured me it unfortunately, this from this contract too, a bulk of it, a good portion of it, goes directly to these insurgent leaders to ensure safe passage, you could call it.
What do the, you quoted several American military officers in the field who acknowledge knowing about this and expressing disgust about it. Did you talk about that?
Yeah, that was David Haight, who runs the 3rd Brigade of the 10th Mountain Division, and he oversees Logar, his brigade oversees Logar Province and Wardak Province, and Highway 1 goes through part of it. And I asked him about it, and he said he was aware of it, and he said it repulsed him. It repulsed him that this was the situation, but he said it is what it is. They know that's the way it is. They know that's the way American contractors are handling business. And at this point, they feel there's nothing they can do about it. Now, there are some things. The point is a lot of people know about it there, and the Afghans are very upset by it, too. A top Afghan security official brought it to my attention. He says he's been trying to fix it in secret for a long time, bring it to the Americans' attention, and little has happened. American contractors, security contractors and trucking contractors said they've brought it to the attention of American officials, American military officials. And they assure me the American military officials have been told, you know, many times, these people don't want to be doing this. They don't want to be paying money to the people that the U.S. is fighting.
Last week, President Obama urged President Hamid Karzai to tackle corruption in his country. In an interview on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer this week, President Karzai said he was trying to root out corruption, but added that foreign money is making the problem worse.
We also mean corruption of a different kind, which is a lot more serious, which is new to Afghanistan. That is, with the arrival of a lot of money to Afghanistan, the lack of transparency in the award of contracts, the serious corruption in implementing projects. It's the international community also that shares responsibility with us, and that's what I hope we can correct together.
Now,
but the stigma falls mainly on Afghanistan because that's where it happens.
That's President Hamid Karzai. Aram Rostan, your response?
He raises a very good point. It is international money. Much of it's American money. This contract I just mentioned, $2.2 billion, that's like a big chunk of Afghanistan's GNP. They functionally don't have much of a budget. It's all international money coming in. You can see a lot of... There has been an effort by U.S. investigators to now probe U.S. contract steering, bribes. There's cases in American court now. People taking bribes, people giving bribes. But there's far more that hasn't been done. It's a really, ironically, he's raising an important point. But, of course, he's also steering the issue to say, don't look at me, look at them.
But isn't the reality that if these companies did not pay these bribes or this extortion, then the U.S. military would have to actually defend these convoys to be able to get supplies to its troops, which would mean more American casualties. So this is, in effect, a way to avoid more American casualties in the war?
That's right. But is that a smart way to fight a war? That's the issue.
I just wanted to go back to the Popel brothers for a minute, Hamid Karzai's cousin, as you said, where you begin the piece, talking about them being businessmen now. You say, though, here in the United States, one, for example, pleaded guilty to, what was it, heroin?
Heroin, yeah, conspiracy. One was 1997 or 1996, whatever I wrote, and one was in 89, he was charged, and he was released from prison in 97.
Conspiring
there were two
to import more than a kilo of heroin.
Right.
Court records show he was released from prison.
Yeah, it was right here in New York City, both cases. That's why it's such a fascinating case, a fascinating place to do reporting. It's like a carnival of really strange characters who are getting very, very rich off this war.
We're going to leave it there. As President Obama, word comes out of the war cabinet he had yesterday that he is raising questions about the surge. We'll see what happens. Aram Rustin, thanks so much for being with us. Investigative journalist. He wrote the book, The Man Who Pushed America to War, The Life, Adventures, and Obsessions of Ahmed Chalabi. But he has the latest story in The Nation magazine called How the U.S. Funds the Taliban. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at the environment and we look at two EPA lawyers who have been threatened for, well, speaking out. Stay with us. Garen Benfield, home here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency is being accused of trying to silence two longtime EPA enforcement attorneys who have publicly criticized a key component of the climate change legislation being considered by Congress. Last week, the EPA directed Laurie Williams and Alan Zabel to remove or edit a video they posted to YouTube that warns a cap-and-trade plan will not effectively combat global warming and is, quote, fatally flawed. The couple instead advocate for a solution involving carbon fees with rebates. The video is titled The Huge Mistake and was posted to the web in September. The agency issued its warning only after the couple published an opinion article in the Washington Post in late October, which echoed concerns raised in the video. The EPA also said they would have to get approval for any future outside writing projects. The video is no longer on the couple's website, but it is available in full through a link posted on the website of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility.
Well, these are the two sentences the EPA ordered Laurie Williams and Alan Zabel to remove from the video or face disciplinary action.
Our opinions are based on more than 20 years each working as attorneys at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the San Francisco Regional Office. In my work at EPA, I have been overseeing California's cap-and-trade and offset programs for more than 20 years.
EPA says it's simply asking the couple to follow government ethics rules that require them to state that their views are their own and not those of the agency. But the couple do state in the video that they were speaking in their capacity as private citizens, parents, and a married couple, and not on behalf of the EPA.
However, nothing in this video is intended to represent the views of EPA or the Obama administration.
Well, Laurie Williams and Alan Zabel join us now from Berkeley, California. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Is this appearance approved by the EPA?
Yes, we do have ethical clearance to continue speaking out on climate change issues. We just had not understood that the restrictions on that clearance prohibited us from describing in detail our government experience, the nature or length of our government experience.
Well, could you talk some about the your objections to the cap-and-trade approach to handling a climate change?
Yes. Basically, as stated in the video, we think that cap-and-trade is, with offsets especially, is fundamentally flawed. And the reason for that is that we think offsets are reductions in greenhouse gases which happen outside the capped sources. And offsets, especially in a world market, cannot be adequately enforced or policed. And you're not sure whether the reductions are real, whether they go beyond what would have happened anyway. And since the cap-and-trade bills before Congress include so many offsets, these programs could be run for approximately 20 years while relying on reductions only from these offsets. And so we think that this fatal flaw locks in climate degradation for approximately 20 years.
You know, I think one of the big problems is that people don't even understand what's being talked about. Like when you talk about cap and trade, when you talk about offsets. Lori Williams, give us a basic lesson, just a thumbnail kind of primer. What are offsets? What's cap and trade?
Okay. Cap and trade means that facilities need to, year by year, reduce their emissions until a certain level is met. That's supposed to be a declining cap. Trading means that if some facilities have more trouble than others reducing their emissions, they can buy pollution permits from other facilities that are having an easier time reducing. However, in this climate bill, facilities can meet their obligation to reduce not only by buying permits from other facilities, but by buying carbon offsets. And the bill specifically authorizes more than 2 billion tons a year of offsets, which would be enough to cover all required reductions for almost 20 years. In addition, there are other problems.
Could you explain what an offset is?
Right. So a carbon offset means some reduction that happens outside the capped sources. And specifically, we give a couple of examples in our video. Sorry, I need a little water. One good example that a lot of people are able to understand is forestry. So let's say you have a forest and I pay you to reduce or stop logging in your forest. That allows me to burn coal above the cap at my coal-fired power plant. But the question is, perhaps you were never planning to cut your forest and now you've just received a bonus for what you're going to do anyway. Or maybe you were planning to cut your forest and now you don't, but demand for wood doesn't go away. So what happens is that economic activity merely shifts to somewhere else. So there's not truly an additional reduction. All you have is extra coal burned above the cap. That's a simple example of a carbon offset.
Or, for example, if you're an international or multinational corporation and you have a forest in Brazil and a forest in the United States, you could reduce your use of the forest in the United States but increase it in Brazil, and that would not be affected?
Right. That's the kind of what's called leakage that results in the carbon offsets not being an additional reduction.
Now, you also mentioned that your experience in California shows you that even the cap part of cap and trade has been used wrongly because the limits on the caps are sometimes artificially high. Could you explain that?
Alan may be better able to understand to explain that.
In the Los Angeles area, there is a program called Reclaim that deals with ground-level smog. And when the program was initially started, it was approximately 70% overinflated, such that it took about 7 years for the reductions in the cap to reach what were the actual emissions. So that was seven lost years.
Can you explain your objection to the Waxman bill, Markey Waxman?
Well, fundamentally, it's twofold. One is the inclusion of the offsets. I mean, we think that really locks in climate degradation. But the second is that we don't think that cap and trade really is ultimately a good or effective mechanism because, as was experienced in Europe, where cap and trade did fail for climate change, it produces price volatility and all sorts of gaming potentials, which are not good for economic activity. If you're going to get people to invest in clean energy, business people need certainty. They need to know that their investments in clean energy are going to be profitable. And cap and trade doesn't provide that certainty.
What we would say is that the major obstacle to a clean energy revolution is the fact that uncontrolled fossil fuels remain a lot cheaper than the clean energy alternatives we have today. That's why a major transition is not yet happening. And a real solution would be fixing that. We don't think that cap and trade with offsets has a near-term chance to fix that. In addition, in Waxman-Markey and in the Kerry-Boxer bill that's been introduced in the Senate, the goals for reductions are extremely weak. So they do not meet what most scientists are saying are necessary to be effective in addressing climate change.
A couple weeks ago, we spoke with the Australian scientist Tim Flannery, who'd come to this country. He was voted Australian of the Year in 2007. We asked him to talk a little bit about cap and trade.
Well, look, cap and trade by itself is not enough, but it is essential in terms of these international negotiations. And one way of showing that is to look at the alternatives. Just say the US went with a carbon tax. That would leave the president in a position where he'd be going to Copenhagen and saying, look, we've got a carbon tax, but we've got no idea really what it's going to do in terms of our emissions profile. So countries would just say, well, what are you actually pledging to? How are you going to deal with your emissions? You know, the only method really to allow countries to see transparently what other countries intend to do and then share the burden equally is through a cap-and-trade system. So it's not enough to deal with emissions overall, but it is an essential prerequisite for any global deal on climate change.
Tim Flannery is also the chair of the Copenhagen Climate Council. By the way, Democracy Now! Will be there broadcasting for 2 weeks from the big summit in December. But Alan Zabel, your response. He's a big proponent of cap and trade.
Well, that assumes that the cap in cap and trade actually works, which we're saying that it doesn't, especially because of these outside offsets. And the experience in Europe really bore that out when they tried to do the Kyoto Protocol 1, and it was pretty much of a dismal failure. It produced lots of price volatility. There were huge windfall profits for utilities, and it produced very little in the way of greenhouse gas reductions.
I think the other thing that happens is the offsets make it look on an accounting basis like you're getting greenhouse gas reductions. Those get counted as reductions when you're in fact getting business as usual. So there's the appearance but not the reality of greenhouse gas reductions.
Well, Laurie Williams, you advocate instead a carbon tax with rebates. Could you explain how that would work?
Yeah. So we are calling this a carbon fee because it's a very targeted amount that you pay when you use uncontrolled fossil fuels. Basically, as we said earlier, the problem is that uncontrolled fossil fuels remain a lot cheaper than clean energy. What we would be proposing, and many economists agree would be effective, is that those 3,000 or 4,000 points around the U.S. where fossil fuels enter the economy, a fee, gradually increasing fee, would be applied such that over 10 to 15 years, the price of uncontrolled fossil fuels would rise above the price of the clean energy alternatives we have today. To keep this affordable for the average consumer, the vast majority of the fees, and potentially all of them, could be returned to consumers, to individuals, in monthly per-person rebates. And what this would mean is that if you only use the average amount of fossil fuels, you would not be in an economically worse position. But if you used more, you would be paying at a much higher rate. So people would have a huge incentive to cut back, but even more important, perhaps, there'd be a huge shift in the incentive for investment in clean energy, since investors would know that clean energy would become profitable within a known time frame. They would have an incentive to move away from investing in coal, in shale oil, in tar sands, and they would have an incentive to invest in all different clean energy possibilities.
And finally, Laurie Williams and Alan Zabel, how popular is your view within the EPA, within the Environmental Protection Agency?
We're not really sure of that. I mean, we get a great deal of support from the people who we know in our office, in our regional office, on a personal basis, but we can't really say how widely shared our viewpoint is.
Well, we want to thank you for sharing it with us today. Thank you for joining us, Laurie Williams, Alan Zabel, EPA lawyers, who posted a video on YouTube that warns a cap-and-trade plan will not effectively control, deal with, combat global warming. They advocate for a solution involving carbon fees with rebates. And you can go to our website where we link to the different YouTube sites that the EPA asked them to take down. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by two women who have made a film about their father. They are Sarah and Emily Kunstler, their father, William Kunstler. The documentary called William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. Stay with us. State, John Lennon here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to a look at a new documentary about a man once described as the most hated and most loved lawyer in America, the late William M. Kunstler. He is the subject of a new documentary directed and produced by his daughters, Emily and Sarah Kunstler.
Growing up, it seemed like my father was at the center of everything important that had ever happened. He fought for civil rights with Martin Luther King Jr. and represented activists protesting the Vietnam War. When the inmates took over Attica Prison, or Native Americans stood up to the federal government at Wounded Knee, they asked my father to be their lawyer. When he spoke about his past, he was like a hero from legend. His clients were fighting to change the world, and Dad was fighting to keep them out of jail. My sister and I weren't around for our father's glory days. Sarah was born in 1976, when Dad was 57. I came along 2 years later.
An excerpt from the new documentary, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe, narrated by his daughter, Emily Kunstler. The film opens on Friday at Cinema Village in New York. The film's directors, Emily and Sarah Kunstler, join us here in our Firehouse studio. They're the founders of Off Center Media, a documentary production company that exposes injustice in the criminal justice system. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Tell us about what made you decide to do this film about your famous father.
Well, you know, Sarah and I got to a point in our lives in our late 20s when we thought it was the right time to look back and think about legacy and our influence. And it seemed natural to investigate the choices that our father had made.
Talk a little, Sarah, about your father. You, too, went the route of, training to be a lawyer, though you decided to go into film.
Yeah, well, I do also practice criminal law. Our father was around. Well, it seemed when we were children that he was at the center of everything important that had ever happened. He worked with Martin Luther King Jr. He defended freedom riders, the Chicago Eight, the inmates at Attica Prison, the American Indian Movement at Wounded Knee. He just seemed to be everywhere. And those were our bedtime stories, this kind of heroic past that our father had led. And when we were children, he spent most of his time close to home in New York doing criminal cases and representing people accused of violent crime.
So the decision to actually go, because there have been some films that have been made of him, the decision to make this personal story, how did you reach that?
I think that it was a part of an investigation that Emily and I had to go through anyway. He passed away when we were teenagers, and that kind of arrested our relationship. We didn't get to kind of sit across a table with him and see him as an adult and a flawed person and a human being and say, you know, I'm okay with you, you're okay with me, the natural progression that happens with parents as we get older. So the film was a way for us to do that. It was a way for us to look at his life and to see what we take from him.
Emily, chronicle your father's life for us briefly. Talk about those cases that you've just referenced, but maybe people, especially young people, aren't even familiar with. How your father rose to prominence and the cases he took on.
Well, you know, he started his career as a movement lawyer in the South, representing the Freedom Riders. And the Freedom Riders would ride buses across state lines and try to integrate the lunch counters at different bus stations across the country and risk arrest. And this was a real, seeing the Freedom Riders risk arrest and brutality really had a big influence on our father. It made him realize that it was the action that really had meaning, that you could sit around and talk all you want, but that it was really putting your being willing to put your life on the line that made a difference. So that really changed the course of his life. And then after that, he went on to represent people protesting the war in Vietnam, the Berrigan brothers and the Catonsville Nine when they burned draft cards with napalm. And then he's most famous for his defense of the Chicago 8, and then the Chicago 7, ultimately, after they were arrested for protesting the Democratic National Convention in 1968. So that really brought him to national prominence.
I wanted to go back to the film William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe, and play an excerpt that deals with one of the most controversial cases your father, William Kunstler, took on in the 1980s.
When I was 10 years old, I remember pleading with him not to represent a teenager accused of a gang rape. But once his mind was made up, nobody could stop him.
Central Park jogger case was a case in which a white female was beaten severely in Central Park. And there were a number of young black youth who were arrested.
The defendants were not that much older than me or Sarah, but it felt like worlds apart.
They were black kids from under 10th Street, and I mean, they were perfect, throw them away. I mean, well, what is it? Of course they did it.
A pack of youths out on a night of wilding, savagely beat and rape a helpless young jogger. They're all arrested. They're called a wolf pack. And everybody hates these kids, and they confess.
And the atmosphere in the city was these guys are dead guilty before trial. Donald Trump had put a full-page ad in the Times saying they should get the death penalty.
To understand is to forgive. I don't want to understand what motivates someone to engage in this kind of horror. I want, rather than to understand him, I want him punished.
It please the court, my name is William Kunstler, and I am arguing for Yousef Salaam. This is the first of the so-called Central Park jogger cases, and we have three issues.
Yousef Salaam became his obsession. For 2 years, Dad wrote appeal after appeal, and finally lost when New York's highest court affirmed the conviction. I was mad at him for taking this case.
An excerpt from the documentary William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. Well, Bill Kunstler died in 1995 at the age of 76. 7 years after his death, there was a startling development in the Central Park jogger case.
You may remember a famous case here in New York. It was called the Central Park Jogger Attack. And back in 1989, it stunned this city, the nation really, and resulted in the arrests of five teenagers. Now it turns out they apparently got the wrong guys. And today, New York prosecutors moved to have all the guilty verdicts set aside.
Yousef Salaam spent 7 years in prison and was exonerated in 2002.
I was that person who was the worst person that ever lived, who needed to be disposed of. People wanted us to be hanging from the tree by the end of the day. To me, the trial wasn't just in the courtroom. The trial was also on the train going to the courtroom. It was walking around my neighborhood on the weekends. It was walking around anywhere, you know. And I was very recognizable. I was always on trial.
I think Dad always believed in Youssef's innocence. But I've realized it was never about innocence for Dad. He looked at Youssef and saw a kid who had been convicted by public opinion and by his own daughters before the case ever went to trial.
The legacy that Bill Kunstler has left is his fights and his struggles were or became also my fights and my struggles. You know, anytime you have injustice or anytime you're faced with any kind of injustice and you're in a position to do something, you have to do something.
I remember my father telling us that all white people are racist, including me and Sarah. But I didn't understand what he meant at the time. He meant that we are blind to the depth of our own prejudice. And that as long as there is prejudice, there can be no such thing as a fair trial.
And that's the terrible myth of organized society, that everything that's done through the established system is legal. And that word has a powerful psychological impact. It makes people believe that there is an order to life and an order to a system, and that a person that goes through this order and is convicted has gotten all that is due him. And therefore, society can turn its conscience off and look to other things and other times. And that's the terrible thing about these past trials, is that they have this aura of legitimacy, this aura of legality. I suspect that better men than the world has known, and more of them, have gone to their death through a legal system than through all the illegalities in the history of man.
William Kunstler, in the film William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. You now do your Q&As after the film this weekend, Cinema Village, with Yusuf Salam. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts now?
You know, that's been one of the great gifts of making this film. It's given us the opportunity to reconnect with Yusuf. You know, we doubted Yusuf's innocence back when we were children. So to be able to share this experience with him, to share the film with him, to give him the opportunity to stand before an audience as an exonerated person has really been a blessing.
He's a hospital administrator now.
He is. He's a hospital administrator. He has four daughters. He's doing wonderfully. And he really enjoys speaking to young people and educating people about his experience.
Of course, that Central Park Jogger case was our Scottsboro boys. It was really, or the Sleepy Lagoon case in Los Angeles in the 1940s. It was everyone, I'd say 99% of the people in the city, including myself, because I sat through that trial and I heard the confessions and I was convinced they were guilty as well. To find out later on what had happened and how prosecutors had totally failed to really investigate the case properly and was an amazing turnaround, I think. And there are still many people in the city who refuse to believe the injustice that was created that by the prosecutors there. But, you know, listening or watching your father again, you know, he was my attorney at one time also in 1969. He defended me as a group of Columbia students who were on trial for contempt of court, did a passionate defense in the trial. He lost the case and we all ended up spending 30 days in jail as a result. But we always, it was worth it just to be able to see him in a courtroom and the respect that the judges showed to him, not merely the those who attended, but the judges themselves knew they were before a legendary figure. And they treated him with a deference and a respect that they wouldn't give to a normal criminal defense attorney or political lawyer. And so he really was one of the towering figures in the American criminal defense in this country.
I wanted to go now to another excerpt of your film, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe, the documentary featuring archival footage of the two of you, Emily and Sarah Kunstler, confronting your father on live TV about his work.
I had always defended my father to the kids at school. This time, I couldn't find the words. But Sarah confronted him on local television.
I was kind of wondering if ever you decided to take a case and then later, you know, did a double take and said, well, you know, I shouldn't be doing this. This isn't something that in my heart I believe is right.
There have been a few times where I would want to get out of a particular case. That's true. But on the other hand, I always had the feeling that once you're in it, that you shouldn't leave it unless something climactic.
He never gave us a straight answer. And I decided I was never going to be like my father.
Well, I don't want to be a lawyer. Me neither.
Well, if you're both committed to change, at least this point, committed to changing things, if you're not lawyers, what do you think is the best vehicle to do that, to carry that out?
Well, some people act and some people defend them, and maybe we're just people of action.
Okay, there you are saying you both don't want to be a lawyer, but there you are, Sarah, you're a lawyer.
I know, and it was committed to tape, and now I'm sharing it with the world, so I have to deal with it. But
I mean, I think that's the power of the film, is the honesty in it, every which way. I mean, you're critical of your father, and you talk to people who were critical of him, and you talk to the people who worked alongside him, and feel without your father, so many of these cases would not have gotten attention.
Yeah, well, there's no question that this is a film made with love, and that this is, in a sense, a love letter to our father. But it's also a critical inquiry. We didn't want to make a puff piece. We wanted to look at him honestly and seriously, and come to terms with his life.
We have a last shot that we want to play. That's for viewers and listeners, sound on tape. Asking about your father representing AIM, the American Indian Movement, this excerpt features interviews with singer and activist Harry Belafonte and AIM leader Clyde Bellecourt.
We're going to put the government on trial, he said. It's not the Indian people that are on trial, it's the government. He said, they're the ones that we're after. They're the ones that are going to be found guilty. He prophesied that.
When Bill asked me to come, he had extended the invitation at the same time to a colleague of mine, Marlon Brando. When we met before going into the court, he says, we have arranged seats where you'll be sitting directly behind Dennis Banks and Russell Means, and make sure that the jury gets full awareness of the fact that you really like these guys and admire them, and you're there to support them. And I said to Bill but Bill, if you're asking us to sit there and to do that, to influence the jury, isn't that jury tampering? He said, everything is jury tampering that goes on in a courtroom.
It's Harry Belafonte. How has this making of the film changed you, Emily and Sarah?
Well, you know, it really brought our father back to life in a lot of ways for us. When he passed away, we were teenagers, so we never had that opportunity. It also, we realized somewhere along the way that our search for consistency, looking for the black and whites, trying to find, you know, some sort of clear answer was inherently flawed, and that, you know, it is our inconsistent moments that brings about change, and that makes us human. So we certainly learned that along the way.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Emily and Sarah Kunstler, good luck on your film coming out. It's going to show in New York Cinema Village, and then it's traveling around the country. And I encourage people to check our website at democracynow.org as we go on our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, be in San Francisco on Saturday. Then I'm headed to Fort Bragg and Santa Rosa and Corte Madera, and moving on to Berkeley and San Francisco, Palo Alto, going through Oregon and Washington State, then to Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. We'll be broadcasting from all these places. You can check out our website for the tour dates at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.